BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
5 years ago, we in the UK were in the false lull between the first wave of COVID and the second, between the first variant and the second, between the first peak of COVID deaths and the second higher peak. There wasn't a vaccine, and we didn't know when we might get one. Now, all that's a memory. But another deadly pathogen might pop up in 50 years, or it might be manifesting its early stages right now. In the final part of our three-part mini-series looking at how resilient the UK might be in dealing with potential future crises, we're asking, how prepared are we to deal with the next pandemic? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. Joining me in the briefing room to discuss all this are Dame Sarah Gilbert, Professor of Vaccinology at the Pandemic Sciences Institute, University of Oxford, Sir Peter Horby, Professor of Emerging Infections and Global Health and Director of the Pandemic Sciences Institute at the University of Oxford, and Marnik Peiris, Emeritus Professor of Virology in the School of Public Health at the University of Hong Kong. Peter Horby, listeners will be wondering, what's the next COVID? Or to put it another way, what is the community worried about now and what's being most closely monitored?
We've got a lot of viruses that we worry about, but I think the big ones are the coronaviruses, so that's the family of viruses from which COVID came, but also, you know, influenza, which I think many people think is a common or garden infection, but actually there's a huge range of flu viruses in animals, and sometimes they spread over into humans and cause pandemics, and they can be very severe. And over the last few years, we've seen an increasing diversity of some of those viruses in birds, but also affecting a range of mammals, which is worrying. So we're definitely watching the flu viruses extremely closely at the moment.
Sarah, I think there are some very particular viruses that you've been concerned with.
Well, there are quite a few viruses that we know have already caused outbreaks in humans and therefore will almost certainly do the same again. What's a bit complicated in dealing with these viruses is they come from different families. And one thing that we did learn in the last pandemic is that viruses that come from different families, different groups, behave somewhat differently, and our response to them needs to be somewhat different. So some of the ones I'm working on are called MERS virus, a vaccine against MERS virus, and MERS stands for Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. That's another coronavirus, so a relative of COVID, of SARS-CoV-2. Also Nipah virus, a different family of viruses that has a very high fatality rate, and Lassa fever virus, again, a different family of viruses. That one's an arena virus, and that tends to cause fever in West Africa and is actually quite common in some parts of West Africa.
How do you spell Nipah, since this is radio?
N-I-P-A-H.
Can you tell us a bit about that one? I think people may have heard of one or two of the others, but I have never heard of that one.
Nipah virus is a very scary virus because it kills more than half the people that it infects. Fortunately, it's not very good at spreading from one person to another. So people get infected because bats carry this virus, fruit bats carry it, and they can transmit it to people by contaminating food sources that people then consume. So it might be fruit that a bat's handled and then dropped and left some of the virus on it, and a person might eat it. Or it might be the sap of date palms, which in Bangladesh in particular, the sap is collected and drunk as a raw drink purported to have health-giving properties. But unfortunately, if a fruit bat that's been infected with Nipah virus has been in the pot trying to drink the date palm sap as well, then it can be contaminated with Nipah virus. And that's the most common way people in Bangladesh get infected. It's starts off, as many viral infections do, with quite non-specific symptoms. People just feel generally unwell or feverish, but then it can develop quite quickly into an infection in the brain and has a high fatality rate. We really don't want to see this virus given the opportunity to cause large outbreaks, because what we see many times over is that when a virus first moves into the human population and then starts to mutate and evolve as it passes from one person to another, it gets more and more efficient at doing that transmission from one person to another. And we really don't want to see that happen with a virus that has such a high fatality rate. So we need to stop the outbreaks very quickly.
What are you keeping your eye on, Marnik?
Well, I think the ones that have been mentioned before, the influenza and coronaviruses, are top of the list, and Nipah as well. But I think since always we can have something unexpected. So the WHO R&D blueprint carried out an exercise over the last 2 years where they went...
Can you just tell me what that is?
It's a WHO organized a research and development blueprint where they, in addition to prioritizing certain virus groups, as we just now discussed, they went virus family by virus family and risk assessed each one and identified a candidate virus from each virus family to be developed in terms of vaccine development, therapeutics, and diagnostics. So, of course, this has to be implemented. At the moment, it's still in the blueprint state. But that gives us also a wider horizon to look at things. But just to take up MERS, which is something that I'm particularly worried about, because it is one virus that has gone from camels to human, to human, to human, to human. So that is three or four cycles of human-to-human transmission, repeatedly in South Korea, in Saudi Arabia. So it is extremely concerning. And the other concern I have about this particular virus is that most of the exposure is taking place in Africa, and there's very little awareness that this is a problem in Africa. And also the virus is present in Central Asia, and we know very little about the virus, the nature of it in Central Asia. So it's a lot of unknowns and a lot of concerns.
Right. What about avian flu, Peter Horby? We've done two programmes about that for the briefing room, and each stage it looked a little bit more urgent.
Yes. You know, avian flu viruses, they're actually the natural reservoir. So water birds are the natural reservoir of influenza viruses. And there's a huge diversity because their genetic code is very sort of promiscuous. They can swap genetic code and they have high mutation rates. So there's a huge diversity of them. And we've seen spread of different avian influenza viruses over many decades. And we've seen it transmitted from birds into mammals. And we've seen humans infected, often with quite high fatality rates, up to 60%. So these are very worrying viruses because we know there's a big diversity. We know they can transmit from the natural reservoir into humans. And we know they can cause pandemics. So the 1918 flu pandemic and other pandemics with influenza. So we watch those, you know, very, very closely. What's worrying at the moment is we're seeing a spread of a particular subtype of the virus called H5N1, which is infecting a lot of different mammal species. And we've seen it now infecting dairy herds in the US, which was very unexpected. And then through the milk, infecting cats and other mammalian species. So that's the one that we really are watching like a hawk. And, you know, many vaccine producers and vaccine developers like Sarah and others are trying to keep up with the evolution of the virus to make sure that we have vaccines ready should it cause a pandemic.
Yeah, I'm very struck by what all three of you have said, is the different possible properties of these viruses and influenza pathogens. Can we talk about how much they might differ in terms of how they spread and in terms of their mortality? Because one of the expectations we always have is that everything will be like the last thing that we had, and it might not be. Sarah Gilbert.
Yeah, so this is one of the reasons that we're now looking at all the different viral families and trying to understand the characteristics of these different families of virus, which will help us be better prepared if a new virus is encountered for the first time. Because then as soon as we can work out which family that new virus belongs to, we will automatically know a lot more about it. So there are different ways that viruses can infect people. We're obviously familiar with the respiratory viruses like influenza and like COVID. MERS is another respiratory virus. Some can infect us through food sources, and Nipah virus is one of those. Lassa fever also tends to infect people through the fact that infected rodents have been rummaging around in their food sources, and the rodents' droppings contain the virus, and then the dust can be breathed in as well as contaminating the food, so people can get infected that way. And in fact, most Lassa fever infections probably are not coming from another person, they're coming directly or indirectly from a rodent. And because these rodents are very good at hiding, people often don't know that they're there and that they're at risk of Lassa fever virus. Other viruses are infected by insects. So insects can carry a virus from one person to another. Sometimes there's quite a complicated life cycle with some parasitic infections such as malaria. There's a whole life cycle that happens within a mosquito. In other cases, it's more just a question of a virus being transported from one person's blood to another person's blood. So if we can try and understand all the different families of viruses, how people get infected, what the infection looks like when it first happens. And also the thing I'm interested in is how strong does the immune response need to be to overcome that virus? Because that's something else that's very different between different viruses.
Yeah, we'll come on a bit more to that question in terms of how you develop vaccines and so on a little bit later. One of the things that's really striking me about this conversation, Malik, is that the model I have in my head is all about human-to-human transmission. At some point or other, the species barrier gets jumped, you get a new kind of mutation, but the problem only comes when humans give it to other humans. But what we're hearing is that there are other ways in which you can get an epidemic or maybe a pandemic without actually having to go from human to human, or have I got that wrong?
No, the initial spillover, if you like, is from animal source to a human for these novel emerging virus infections. But in order for it to cause a major outbreak or a pandemic, the pathogen has to really adapt to transmit human to human to human.
Right.
Now, of course, you can get infections from food and water and things like that, but those are likely to be fairly geographically limited. So it is once a pathogen really learns or adapts to transmit human to human, and particularly transmit by the respiratory route human to human, that is when we really have quite a scary situation. Because that is, as we saw from COVID-19 and a few years ago, in 2009, with the H1N1 pandemic, which came from pigs, I mean, within weeks and months, it is everywhere.
Peter Horby, how much are you in the scientific community battling against the set of assumptions that people have about the likelihood of a pandemic? I mean, you hear people will say things like something like, well, look, we had the flu pandemic in 1980, but it took a century for the next one. So it'll be a century for the next one to come to us now.
Yes, I mean, I think there's a number of fallacies. One you've already mentioned, you know, we think that the next thing's going to be like the last things, fighting the last war. You know, there's more than 11,000 different viral species. So although we can have a good guess of what's likely, there's a whole sea of viruses out there that could cause a pandemic. So we need to be ready for anything. And secondly, you have, you know, what you might call the gambler's fallacy, where you think that the likelihood of a future independent event is dependent on what's just happened previously. It's like, you know, flipping a coin. If you had four heads in a row, you think, well, there's bound to be a tail next, but actually the probability is completely unchanged by what happened previously. So we're just as likely to have a pandemic next week as we are in 100 years. We shouldn't fall into the assumption that we've had a big outbreak, we've had a pandemic, so we'll be safe for the next 10 years, etc. And what we do see is we do really see that reflected in the interest of politicians and drug companies and funders of research. It cycles just like the pandemics do. We get huge investment when there's a crisis. Then as soon as the crisis is over, everyone has short memories and turns away and funds other stuff and does other stuff, which, you know, leaves us who are trying to prepare for the next pandemic by, you know, putting together diagnostics and drugs and vaccines in a very, you know, volatile situation where it's real famine or feast when it comes to funding and interest.
And I want to come on to precisely that question and how we deal with it a little bit later. But Malik, I want to take us on to the question of behaviour, because one of the things we really learned, I started off the last pandemic thinking this was a purely scientific question, that epidemiology was purely about the behaviour of a virus. And then discovered that how you deal with a pandemic is a lot about the behaviour of human beings. In fact, a lot of it is. Can you just remind us of why that's the case?
Indeed. I mean, many of us scientists really, we focus on the science and the virus and the immune response and all that. But a very important component in dealing with an outbreak like this is how people behave and respond to such an outbreak. So, I mean, what we saw very clearly during the last pandemic is that there are, even before vaccines and antivirals and drugs and interventions had been developed for COVID-19, it was clear that what are called public health and social measures, that means social distancing, a whole range of things, not just lockdowns, there's a whole range of measures that can be implemented to reduce the chance that one person may transmit infection to another, could very dramatically reduce the spread of a respiratory disease. Now, of course, these do have drawbacks, meaning obviously it limits people's movement, it limits the economy and things like that. So that is one side of it. Now, in Hong Kong, actually, we were quite successful for the first 2 years in essentially keeping COVID at bay. We had less than 1% of the population infected by 2022. And we had vaccines which were being given. 70% of the population had been vaccinated. But unfortunately, the elderly were extremely hesitant to take up the vaccine. And then finally, when the dam broke in 2022 with the arrival of Omicron, sadly, we had a very unpleasant and significant mortality with COVID, because those people who are at highest risk because of various behavioral issues did not wish to take the vaccine. So all these things show us that we really need to understand human behavior, understand how we can communicate these issues much better.
Malik, that's really fascinating, because was the possibility of such resistance to vaccination built at all into the modelling of the progress of the pandemic, or was it a surprise?
No, it was a surprise. And indeed, it was even more of a surprise because 70% of Hong Kong's population had taken up the vaccine. So it was not as if there was a huge anti-vaccine messaging going around. It was just that the older people thought that to some extent, maybe they felt reassured for the first 2 years. They were not at risk. They didn't see their neighbors and friends having serious outcomes. And maybe they thought, well, I'm protected by the community, so I don't have to take the vaccine. So it's extremely complicated. I mean, I'm simplifying things. There were many, many factors that fed into that belief, but it had disastrous consequences.
Peter Horby, one of the problems which was identified in the UK by the government in the early days of the COVID pandemic was an idea that there would be a reluctance by people to obey stringent regulations, and it turned out that that wasn't the case. But might it not be the case a second time round? Is there a worry that people would be more reluctant now to do it again?
I mean, it's hugely important, looking back when I was on the scientific advisory committee for the government, SAGE, very early on, some of the non-biological scientists, the sort of the historians, the social scientists, people who were working in different areas to me said, oh, well, when can we expect resistance? And I remember I was quite shocked. Somebody said, well, there's a high likelihood at some point of rioting. And I was shocked by this. I thought, well, we're trying to do our best and we'll tell people what we think is the best for the country. And hopefully people should agree with that and go along with the recommendations. And largely people did at the start, but we did see as the time progressed that resistance to the measures did increase. There were episodes of, I guess, sort of a bit of social resistance to some of the stuff that was being doing. And it really showed me that, biological science is only one part of the solution. We really need sort of social scientists, anthropologists, historians who can really understand in the broader context of society, how people in societies respond and how you build trust and honesty and communication to make sure that you don't end up in the situation which I feel we're in now, which is with a huge polarization of views about, particularly about some of the social measures as to whether they were the right thing to do or the wrong thing to do. We see people saying that, bioscientists should either go to Stockholm for a Nobel Prize or to Nuremberg to be tried for war crimes. We're seeing quite extreme views now, quite polarized views, and we have to think how we can avoid that in the future.
Sarah Gilbert, how did the fact that we were in a pandemic alter the way in which you had to go about getting the vaccinations up and running?
Well, actually conducting vaccine trials before the vaccine was ready to be used on a large scale, doing that in a pandemic was something new for us, something we'd never had to deal with before. And in fact, when we started developing the vaccine in Oxford that we worked on, we weren't really thinking about the fact that we would be testing it under such very different conditions. We thought we would do our normal clinical trial. But actually, by the time we were ready to start the clinical trial, we'd already been in lockdown for some time. And so we had to completely revise our procedures. Normally, when we're inviting volunteers to come in for a clinical trial, there's quite a lot of personal interaction. You have an interview with somebody who can tell you all about the trial and you can ask as many questions as you would like. And then obviously you'll see somebody when you're given your vaccination, you'll have various checkups. We had to really minimize all of that, minimize all of the personal interaction, use videos a lot more to answer questions. And then we had to start thinking about how to direct people, what route they should take when they came into the clinical trial centre. Because as well as having people coming in to have their vaccinations and to have their checkups and have blood samples taken after the vaccinations, we also required people to come and see us if they felt they had any symptoms of COVID infection. So we had to be very, very careful to manage different areas. And in fact, we had to expand our facilities by adding two large mobile buildings just so that we had enough space to run a clinical trial with people socially distanced so that we didn't have any possibility of somebody who was infected bumping into somebody else on the way in or out of the clinic. And it made things very, very difficult. And obviously in hospital settings, it wasn't always possible to add that extra space and to organise things quite as easily as we could do in the clinical trials. And there is evidence that when people first started to go to get their vaccines, a few people were probably infected on that visit when they went to get their vaccination, because there was still a lot of virus around. So overall, it was a very good thing. But there were a few people who were perhaps exposed at that point. And that's something we need to think about more in future. One of the ways to do that is to really try to have the vaccines ready as early as possible, because the earlier we can control the outbreak, the fewer people we actually need to vaccinate. And that's what we would like to aim for.
Malik, with COVID, old people were the worst affected, and that might have had an impact upon the way in which people looked at the measures that were required. Of course, it's the case, and you've suggested, that might not be the next demographic that is most hit. How do you think a different demographic being hit by a virus or a pathogen might alter the behavioural assumptions?
Yeah, that's a very important point, because I think, so for example, hypothetically, let us say a particular epidemic or a pandemic is particularly affecting children, the social reaction would be extremely different, I would think. And similarly, if it is something that is hitting young adults, again, the response would be different. So again, if you go back to the 1918 flu epidemic, which has been referred to, which was, as we read from, you know, the accounts of that pandemic, it predominantly affected healthy young adults. And to some extent, it probably made people more accept wearing of masks. And there were even something equivalent to lockdowns in certain states and certain cities, even in the United States at that time. So I think what people will accept in terms of restrictions of mobility and things like that also depends on what they perceive to be the impact and who particularly is being impacted by such a virus.
Which makes public health messaging absolutely central, doesn't it, Peter Horby?
Yes, absolutely. You know, just picking up on Malik's point, there are plenty of viruses that predominantly affect children. Just look at sort of, you know, measles and chickenpox and polio, for example. Polio comes from a very big family of viruses. It's entirely possible we could get a new polio type virus. And I think it would very much change people's perceptions if children were predominantly infected. The public health response, you know, I think we probably can do better. The very extreme, you know, almost the nuclear option public health of entirely locking down society, you know, I think had lots of ramifications, you know, social and economic ramifications. And I think we ought to be able to do better than that, and that we could, with modern technologies like, you know, people's smartphones and their wearable apps on their wrists, do much better in targeting public health interventions in a way that's more precise.
I want to shift us on now to preparedness. We're 5.5 years on from the start of the COVID outbreak. Are we in the UK better prepared now to deal with any future pandemic threat, do we think? Sarah Gilbert.
Well, I don't know that we are, really. I don't think we have done as much as any of the three of us would have liked to have achieved in those 5.5 years. We would all like to have seen a real concentration on what were the lessons, how can we do better next time, let's keep working on these, and things really, attention has been diverted elsewhere. So I don't think we've made a huge amount of progress. There are some important developments. As Malik was talking about, the WHO organised effort to look at different families of viruses, work out what's out there that we should be most worried about, and what a new virus is going to be most like. How can we be better prepared to deal with a new viral infection? That is something that is definitely going in the right direction, but I don't think has advanced very far yet.
Can I push you a little bit further on the question of what we haven't done that you might have expected, that you did expect us to do, and why we haven't done it?
Well, we were already working on vaccines against some of these viruses before the pandemic, and I would have liked to see that work really accelerate post-pandemic, but it hasn't. It stopped during the pandemic. It sort of limped along for a bit, and now it's gradually moving slowly again, but at quite a slow pace. We really had an opportunity to put what we learned into practice and haven't done that very effectively, I think. It's still not clear to me if there was a pandemic starting next week, as Peter's reminded us, is a possibility. Where we would manufacture those vaccines in the UK, we don't have the facilities to actually make vaccines on a large scale. So that's one of the gaps that we're left with.
OK, Peter Horby, what do you think about that? The point that Sarah zeroed in on has been vaccine manufacture. I suppose you could say, what have we done on vaccine development? What have we done on vaccine manufacture? What have we done on learning the kind of public health lessons and having the health system prepared? So if you can take some of those on.
Yeah, I think in terms of the broader sort of decision making, I'm hoping the COVID inquiry will come out with some sensible recommendations. They certainly did with module one. My worry is that it's taking so long that actually no one will care. It's already 5 years. That could have been a very valuable process, but I worry about the speed of it. And the UK government and the Health Security Agency in the UK are in the middle of a big national exercise Pegasus, to look at future pandemic planning. So I'm hoping that planning and policy and public health side will improve with those two things. When it comes to diagnostic tests, treatments and vaccines, I have to agree with Sarah that we have seen a disinvestment from that space, even though we've seen that you can achieve remarkable things with vaccines within a year and new treatments within 6 months, 100 days. But without the investment in the early stage product development, those things aren't going to be ready. And I think from my own perspective, the area I work in, the development of new treatments is really lags behind. Industry and government really are not investing in that space for pandemic preparedness.
Despite the fact that you have told them, and actually we heard them say, that they would learn that lesson. So very briefly, Peter, why has it not happened? Is it just simply a matter of the attention goes somewhere else?
In most of the investment in these things comes from industry, and I think a lesson that industry has learned from the pandemic is, particularly in the therapeutic space, it's a very difficult business case for them, because you don't know if a pandemic's going to come, you don't know exactly what it'll be, and you don't know if people want to use the drugs, and you don't know if governments will buy the drugs. So they're really not investing in developing therapeutics and diagnostics for these future threats. And then governments have, huge competing financial priorities. We see that every day in the news in the UK at the moment. There's really pressing crises that need to be dealt with today, this week, this year. And pandemics just gets kicked into the long grass as usual.
Malik, is that the picture worldwide? I mean, is that just the UK? Are they doing better elsewhere or no different?
No, indeed. I mean, this is a problem everywhere. And in many parts of the world, it is even worse. For example, in terms of manufacturing capacity and vaccine manufacturing capacity and things like that is even worse. So I think the crucial point is what Peter mentioned. Essentially, the pharmaceutical industry, they are businesses, right? But pandemics are totally unpredictable. And, you know, who in their right mind would invest huge amounts of resources, and it does take a huge amount of resources to develop a vaccine for a particular virus, take it to phase one, phase two, phase three clinical trials, etc. Who will do that when it is totally unpredictable whether a particular virus will cause a problem or not? So this is where really that type of investment, whether it be for vaccines or for antiviral drugs, really has to come from the governmental or international level. And I'm afraid, although soon after the pandemic, there was a fair bit of mobilization and activity, it is now sort of waning off, I'm afraid.
Sarah Gilbert, one of the decisions that's been taken in the States has been by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Robert Kennedy, to scrap grants for mRNA vaccine research. And I'd like you to tell us what mRNA actually is and how it differs from previous vaccines.
Well, mRNA vaccines are something that have been in development for about 20 years before the pandemic, but hadn't really been used very widely. They've been particularly in development as therapeutic vaccines to treat cancer, and they will continue to be used in cancer treatments, I think, as well as being more widely used to prevent infections. So what we used to use 50 years ago as vaccines would be something derived from the virus itself. So you either produce a large amount of the virus, such as the flu virus, inactivate it chemically so that it can't cause an infection in the person, and then that's what's injected into somebody so that their immune system gets a chance to look at the flu virus, but it's a dead flu virus. The immune system can recognize it and start to make a response to it, but it doesn't make that person ill. Well, the other way of making vaccines used to be what we called attenuated vaccines. So the virus was still live, but it had been modified so that it couldn't make somebody ill. It would spread a little bit in the body after vaccination, but the immune system would very quickly respond and shut the infection down. That's a very slow process to develop either of those types of vaccine for a new virus. And so what we've moved on to is using what we call platform technologies, and mRNA vaccines are one example of a platform technology where we only need to know the genetic sequence of a virus. We don't have to handle the virus itself. And we can take the genetic sequence that makes the protein on the outside of the virus, so that was the spike protein for coronaviruses, and we encode that into messenger RNA, which is something that we would normally have in our body. It's how our body learns, receives the instructions to make proteins. And that RNA, the coding sequence for the spike protein, is wrapped up in a fatty coat to protect it. And that's what's injected into the arm. And then the RNA will make its way inside a cell, and that will tell that cell to make the coronavirus spike protein at the same time as the vaccination itself, and the fatty coat is causing a certain amount of inflammation in the area where the vaccination was given. So the immune system's receiving the message that there's something going on here. We need to respond to this unknown protein. There's lots of this new spike protein being made. So we'll make a strong immune response against this spike protein. And then, of course, the vaccine doesn't actually cause an infection. But when somebody does encounter the coronavirus and they see the spike protein on the outside of a virus for real this time, they've already got the antibodies, they've got the immune system trained in how to respond, and they can move very quickly. So there are a few different technologies: mRNA vaccines, DNA vaccines, adenovirus vaccines. They all work in a very similar way by taking the coding sequence for part of the pathogen, part of the virus inside the body, and training the immune system to recognise it.
Right. So, Peter Horby, if I could ask you this, what do you make of a decision to defund mRNA vaccine research on the basis, I believe, that it is supposedly less effective or may be harmful?
Well, I think the broad picture of funding in the US for some of the underpinning science for pandemic preparedness is a blow to all of us. It's not just about the mRNA vaccines. There's also been cutting of funding for drug development. And the US has traditionally been probably the biggest investor in early stage development of therapeutics and vaccines for pandemic threats through government agencies, because as we've talked about, it's not really a commercially viable prospect. And with that cut in funding, I think the rest of the world is left more vulnerable. I think governments around the world have to step up, because there is now, a serious gap, I think, in funding from the US for some of the basic research that needs to be done.
Can I take us to an area which may be slightly more hopeful, Sarah Gilbert, which is, we're very used on this programme to invoking and discussing artificial intelligence. I presume AI could be used to help us here with pandemic preparedness.
Well, there may well be ways in which AI could help us. In my own field in vaccine development, we still have to do all of the testing. We have to demonstrate that a vaccine we've made is safe to use in a person, will induce the right kind of immune response. And we have to provide a substantial body of data to regulators before a vaccine can be licensed for more widespread use, even in an emergency situation. So a lot of people are starting to use AI to help them design vaccines, but we still have to test those vaccines. And as yet, I haven't seen anything that's actually worked particularly more quickly or particularly more effectively than what we were doing previously. It may take some time before we really understand how to do that better. I think what we may be starting to use AI for, though, is to look at the immune response in our early phase clinical trials, so that the first people that we vaccinate with a new vaccine, can we understand what that looks like, and then use AI to help us predict whether that is going to be an effective immune response and whether it will be effective in all parts of the population. Can we predict if a immune response looks like this in a healthy 30-year-old, is it going to work in an 80-year-old? And that's where I think it might be really quite useful for us.
Peter Horby, can AI help us with things like diagnostics and new treatments?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, certainly there is, very powerful methods now to look at designing and optimizing the targets, on the virus for diagnostic tests and for treatments. And so we really are seeing that kind of computer-assisted design is really helpful and can accelerate some parts of the process. But as Sarah says, you still need to test these, medicines in humans, and that is a big task. But I want to be more optimistic there. What we did see in the pandemic was that you can accelerate this development tremendously in a way that no one, I think, really would have anticipated. The speed of vaccine development, we had new drugs within a year, and we had everyone using lateral flow devices, these sort of, home point of care tests, which all of these things were pretty much unthinkable. You could do those things at that scale and speed in the past. So we now have set a new bar of what is possible. So I think that is a real step forward.
I'm just wondering at the point whereby wearables might actually be able to do some of these diagnostic tests, but maybe some way away from that. Marlik, can I go back to a point that you raised earlier, which is really about how the world reduces the risk of a new pandemic? You've talked about spillover. Is there something we can do to begin to slow down or prevent spillover in the way which we do agriculture, in the way in which we interact with animals, or anything else?
Indeed. So, I mean, if you just go back, look at the last 30 years, almost every 3 or 4 years, we have had a major spillover event which has caused a major outbreak. So 1997, we had the bird flu in Hong Kong. In 2003, we had SARS-1, which of course spread around the world, but luckily didn't become a pandemic. A few years later, we had the 2009 influenza pandemic, which came from pigs. Then we have had Zika, we have had Ebola, we have had outbreaks of Lassa. Then we had MERS and COVID. And even after COVID, we have had Mpox. So you can see the number of these spillover events that are taking place. And the problem is that we humans are actually increasing the risk of these spillovers and the consequences of these spillovers, and increasing the risk of the spillover by the way we carry out our agriculture, by the way we carry out our trade, for example, the wild game animal trade, which we clearly showed was responsible for SARS coronavirus 1 outbreak in 2003, and very likely was responsible for the COVID pandemic as well, but it has become so controversial, unfortunately. And for example, the international pet trade, which includes wild animals being moved across countries for exotic pets. And some of these wild animals being used as pets come from many parts of the world, which we know carry potentially epidemic and pandemic viruses. So what we humans are doing and our changes of our behavior, like international travel, all these increase the risks of spillover and the risks of the consequences of spillover. Now, obviously, intensive agriculture is good. It provides food. So I'm not advocating for an abolishment of intensive agriculture. But there are critical points that we can intervene where we can dramatically reduce the risk of these spillover events. And I think that is an aspect which, to a large extent, is being neglected as well.
My thanks to Malik Pearis, Sarah Gilbert and Peter Horby. And my conclusion, it looks like we've taken our eyes off the ball and we need to get them back on it. And just before we go, a quick reminder that you can subscribe to the Briefing Room podcast on the BBC Sounds app and you will get access to the entire back catalogue, including the one about Britain's missing workers, the one about how much we should worry about government debt, and the first two parts of our resilience mini-series focusing on climate preparedness and cyber threats. Now that's the end of this current series, but we will be back in early October. Goodbye.
I'm Mark Steele, and for BBC Radio 4 from Shadow World, this is The People vs. McDonald's.
Hi, boys and girls. How you doing today? It's Ronald McDonald, your friend, and boy, gosh, by golly, we're going to have a lot of fun today.
The longest-running trial in English history.
I just felt totally burnt out, and I wasn't really able to carry on.
A gardener and a former postman against a global fast food giant.
Corporations should not just be able to suppress people.
With secret surveillance, spies, and life-changing deception.
You start thinking, what is reality and what's not reality?
Subscribe to The People vs. McDonald's on BBC Sounds.